This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeff Charlotte, has spent the past few years reporting on the secretive Christian fundamentalist group known as the Family, or the Fellowship, and how it's promoted anti-gay, anti-abortion, and pro-free market policies in the U.S. as well as in other countries. Powerful politicians and world leaders are affiliated with the group. In fact, some politicians live or have lived at a residence near the Capitol known as the C Street House, which Charlotte has reported is run by a family affiliate known as the C Street Foundation. Last year, the secrecy of the C Street House was broken when it was reported that one of its residents, Senator John Ensign, was having an affair with his campaign aide's wife. Senators Tom Coburn and Jim DeMint and Congressman Zach Womp, Bart Stupak, and Heath Shuler were also living at the C Street House. Stupak and Ensign have since moved out. Jeff Charlotte's new book is called C Street, and it's about how the Family and other fundamentalist groups are influencing American politics, policy, and the military, raising questions about the separation of church and state. Charlotte is a contributing editor for Harper's Magazine. Jeff Charlotte, welcome back to Fresh Air. Well, let's look at one of the C Streeters in the news, Senator Jim DeMint of South Carolina. He's been very active in supporting Tea Partiers. He was described by the Associated Press as having done as much as anybody else to incite the Tea Party uprising and bitter infighting that has riled GOP primaries this year. He supported Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, and she won in the Republican primary. Rand Paul in Kentucky, Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania. He's given these candidates financial support as well. So let's look at Christine O'Donnell. Now, she's an example of a candidate the Republican Party did not endorse. The Delaware State Republican Party chair called her a fraud who couldn't get elected dog catcher, but now he's in the position of having to support her. What was Jim DeMint's help or contribution to her campaign?
Well, what Jim DeMint is doing for all these candidates and what makes him such an interesting figure is representing this convergence of a kind of populist fundamentalism with the elite fundamentalism represented by figures like DeMint, the folks who are not outsiders like O'Donnell, but insiders. They're in Washington and granting a kind of legitimacy. Even as certain factions within the Republican Party struggle against it, DeMint's coming out on top and race after race. And that's one of those moments that you look at when populist and elite fundamentalism converge like that, that it becomes a much more politically and culturally potent force, a transformative moment.
Well, one of the things I find interesting about his helping to empower the Tea Party is that the Tea Party seems to be based on more of economic disenchantment with the bailout, with federal spending, as opposed to, you know, Christian values. It emphasizes federal bailouts and its opposition to that more than it emphasizes its you know, any opposition to homosexuality, for example. Mm-hmm. So do you see him as bridging a more kind of libertarian streak within the Tea Party to a more fundamentalist streak within politics?
You know, I don't see Senator DeMint as bridging that gap as being sort of a gatekeeper. As this establishment figure, he's saying to the Tea Party movement that does contain a lot of sort of traditional libertarians who don't want to get into, don't see themselves religiously motivated, and says, you want to get into the halls of power, you're going through me. I'm the man who can take you there. I'm your Moses. And I see this movement, he's been explicit about this, as a great awakening, as a religious movement. And there are enough people in the Tea Party movement who share that view, and he can shape it. He wrote a book last year called Saving Freedom, We Can Stop America's Slide into Socialism, in which he creates a sort of paradox of libertarian authoritarianism. You know, on the one hand, this sort of radical laissez-faire economics combined with an authoritarianism that he roots in his religion, although it doesn't look like a Christianity most of us are familiar with. It's more about power and where is the source of government. And for him, the only legitimate source of government is God. And so he sees that actually as informing the shape of the Tea Party, that the Tea Party, by rebelling against big government, is carrying out God's mandate to turn over the economy, to turn over governance to him, God, and his chosen ones, Senator DeMint.
How do you think that DeMint's championing of some Tea Party candidates is affecting his status within the Republican Party? Because a lot of the Tea Party candidates were, in some instances, including Christine O'Donnell, going against the candidate endorsed by the party.
You know, the person who is being most helped by DeMint's endorsements is Jim DeMint. You know, everybody knows that endorsements ultimately don't matter that much in politics. But there's another level in which Jim DeMint is emerging as a guy who knows how to pick winners, a guy who, you know, knows which way the wind is blowing. And the Republican Party is increasingly going to have to say, either we're going to take a stand and fight against this, or we are going to follow Jim DeMint. Jim DeMint is a leader. And he certainly emerged as a leader of one faction. You know, you hear the inevitable chatter that maybe he'll run for president. I think that's unlikely, and I don't think he'd get there. His role is much more that of a kingmaker. He has now staked out a faction. And he's done that work of bridging these two traditionally at odds factions of the Republican Party, which is a sort of economic libertarianism and the religious conservatism. And in that way, he is an exemplar of the family's theology of the C Street approach to politics, which is to see those two things as not at odds, that kind of laissez-faire economics and religious conservatism and authority, not at odds, but as one and the same, as each an expression of the other.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeff Charlotte. His new book, C Street, is about how Christian fundamentalists have tried to reshape American politics and the military. It's the follow-up to his bestseller, The Family, about the evangelical Christian group that includes powerful senators and congressmen. So Tuesday of this week, Republicans prevented a vote in the Senate on overturning Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And in thinking about that story, I was reminded of a quote in your book, C Street, because you have a whole chapter on fundamentalists and the military. And you quote Colonel Bob Young, who was a commander at Kandahar Air Base. His battalion was responsible for logistics support for combat operations through southern Afghanistan. And he said to you, "There's a sense in which the military is now the only safe place to be. In the military, homosexuality is illegal. I don't want to get into all the particulars of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but you can't act on homosexual feelings. And adultery is illegal. Arguably, the military is the last American institution that tries to uphold Christian values. It's the easiest place in America to be a Christian." I'm wondering if you heard that sentiment expressed by others, that because of things like Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which make it against regulations to openly discuss or express your homosexuality, that the military is the last safe institution for Christians.
Yeah, I heard that very commonly. I mean, first, I should say the vast majority of military personnel understand their oath to the Constitution and understand why they're there and their duty. But there is a very significant movement within it that sees the military as a Christian institution. They see themselves as Christian warriors. They see themselves as responsible for protecting and defending America's tradition as a Christian nation and representing that overseas. And for a lot of them personally, it just meshed well with their personal beliefs because they didn't have to engage in these kinds of culture war issues, and the military has decided for them, and that decision comes down on terms that are very comfortable for religious conservatism.
Do you think the group of people who believe that are large enough to have influenced the continuation for now of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Absolutely. There's an organization called Officers Christian Fellowship, 15,000 members, and they're officers, obviously. Includes many top-ranking generals and former generals and admirals. They define their mission as reclaiming territory for the Christ in the military, not allowing the opposition, all of which is spearheaded by Satan, to stand in the way. And that's from their sort of mission statement of what they're doing. They even refer to military personnel who may be Christian but not saved, not evangelical, as unwittingly doing the work of the enemy, as spiritual terrorists. They even refer to people who don't share their religious beliefs. And we're talking about folks like General Bob Caslin, a senior commander, General Robert Van Antwerp, another senior commander. So when you have that level of command committed to the idea that the military exists to embody their understanding of Christian values, it's not surprising that they can exert a force or a political influence that even a lot of the officers with a clearer understanding of their duty find hard to resist.
In your chapter in the book C Street about fundamentalists in the military, You describe a powerful movement within the military of people who think of themselves as spiritual warriors who are trying to displace the military's once staunchly secular code with religious authority. And the secular code you refer to is Order 1B, which forbids proselytizing of any religion or faith or practice.
That's actually an order for Iraq and Afghanistan. That's a more recent order. The real secular order to which I'm referring is the First Amendment of the Bill of Rights, which has the Establishment Clause that says government can't establish religion. It has a Free Exercise Clause, which says you have a freedom to exercise your religious beliefs or not exercise your religious beliefs. And a lot of these officers, these leadership, are in violation, clear violation of both. And then there's other officers. The military's gone so far astray, other officers aren't even – they've lost sight of the First Amendment. I spoke to General John Regney, a three-star in the Air Force, and I tried to talk to him about his understanding of this. I thought it was a softball question. He wasn't familiar with the Establishment Clause. I read to him the First Amendment. He consulted with two of his advisors, a colonel and a retired colonel, said they weren't quite familiar with those constitutional things and ultimately decided to pass on the question.
Give us another example of how you think the military, that certain fundamentalists within the military are trying to displace the military's secular code with religious authority.
You know, it happens in the sort of, you know, there's no conspiracy here. There's no, you know, we're going to take over the military. It's an idea of cultural transformation. And while there's other issues, but you see in the sort of this personal level, I interviewed so many Iraq veterans who would tell stories of coming back from Iraq, getting off the plane and being forced, to stand at attention while a senior officer told them that they had been fighting for Christ. And that's not what they had been there for. Or others who would describe situations where they had lost a fellow soldier who they knew not to be a Christian, and yet his sacrifice being put in Christian terms. And while this all may seem symbolic, it's hard to express how troubling that it was to those folks to say that they had gone there thinking they were doing one thing and have their mission repurposed, and repurposed in the very terms that the people they were fighting, you know, the very terms that Al-Qaeda uses to describe America, to say that America's fighting a crusade. Well, it's hard to convince people that you're not fighting a crusade when you have someone like General Bruce Pfister describing the war in Iraq and Afghanistan as a spiritual war of the greatest magnitude.
There was a scandal in 2005 about proselytizing within the Air Force Academy. Would you review what happened there for us?
Well, that's really a story. It revolves around a man named Mikey Weinstein, who is the head of an organization called Military Religious Freedom Foundation. And Weinstein was a graduate of the Air Force Academy himself, and he sent two sons there. And they happened to be Jewish. And they had encountered really a lot of anti-Semitism. And you know, these were young academy guys. They weren't guys to sort of give in quickly, but it was pervasive. And so they started looking into this and started talking to other people, discovering that a lot of other cadets had experiences not with anti-Semitism, but with faculty promoting their Christian ideas from the head of the classroom. General Johnny Wida, who was a senior commander there, developing a Christian code for cadets to shout back special privileges for Christian cadets, so extensive that one of the whistleblowers, Captain Melinda Morton, who was a chaplain there at the time, described an environment where your religious beliefs had become instrumental to determining your future career in the military. That was especially disturbing to her because she was counseling a lot of young women cadets who would come in there and had learned that their place as women was not to become fighter pilots, but to be in a position where they could stay closer to home. They could raise a family. And that was very upsetting to her on all sorts of levels, but not just as a person who believes in women's rights, but also as an officer in recognizing you're skewing the talent pool. You're taking women who are the best fighter pilots and moving them aside so that men who are presumably designated by God for this kind of combat can be moved up the ladder.
Now, the group that you referred to, the MRFF, the Military Religious Freedom Foundation, more recently wrote a letter with Veterans for Common Sense to Secretary of Defense Robert Gates, saying that the military's practice of substituting religion for professional mental health care for post-traumatic stress disorder and suicide prevention has become increasingly frequent. What do you know about that?
Yeah, that's been sort of one of the sort of the saddest cases. Is this replacement of good mental health counseling and frankly good chaplain spiritual advising for those who want it and need it with a kind of a proselytizing agenda. One of the things I looked at that the Military Religious Freedom Foundation had found was a PowerPoint presentation given to about 1,000 airmen at an airbase in United Kingdom based on The Purpose-Driven Life, Pastor Rick Warren's big evangelical bestseller. But this is called The Purpose-Driven Airman, and this was to give you everything you needed to deal with your depression issues. It was described as a suicide prevention work. It was created by a chaplain named Christian Biscotti, a graduate of Pat Robertson's University. And it says, here there are three levels of purpose that you can choose from in your life. And on top is God-given. And then down the scale is man-given, which is described as philanthropy, and that's described by Karl Marx. You don't want that. And at the bottom of the heap, there's self-given purpose, and that's championed by Darwin, and you don't want to have anything to do with that. So unless you have a God-given purpose, unless you are an airman who sees yourself as doing your duty for God, you're going to be exposed to this kind of crippling depression, a spiritual war, you know, being launched on you by dark forces and all this kind of stuff. And it could lead to suicide is the thinking. Well, that was presented to 1,000 airmen. It was then shared with more airmen. And, you know, as I started to talk to soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen to find out if they had experienced similar ideas, what was astonishing to me was that this was not a case of a bad apple, someone who didn't understand the rules. This was someone who was kind of following protocol.
You trace part of the evangelical power within the military to the mid-1980s when the process of accrediting military chaplains changed. How did the process change?
Well, there was a great withdrawal of chaplains from the old mainline Protestant denominations, the Episcopalians and the Methodists and the traditional Presbyterians who were leaving in a large part. That was a legacy of the Vietnam War. And there was a shortage of chaplains. And so the military, through no attempt to create this fundamentalist movement, started really radically broadening first the accrediting agencies that it recognized chaplains from. So Bible colleges, where instead of learning about all different faiths and, you know, how to minister to troops of all different faiths, you learn that there's a right way Christianity, my kind of Christianity, and a wrong way, everything else. Suddenly those people started infusing the military. And at the same time, they lifted regulations that said, okay, you got 10% Presbyterians, you should have roughly 10% Presbyterian chaplains. That doesn't mean you get a Presbyterian chaplain, but you know they're out there. That's all gone. And now we've reached a point where, according to one chaplain who is herself a history of the chaplaincy, about 80% of the chaplains describe themselves as conservative or evangelical. And when I looked, at least more than 60%, about two-thirds, are affiliated with denominations that you would describe that way.
Looking at the past few years in terms of how you think some evangelicals have abused the First Amendment in the military. Do you think that things have improved since then?
It's really hard to know. You know, I spoke to a three-star general who wants to remain anonymous, and that's a sign of the times. When a three-star general who's critical of what he sees as a pervasive fundamentalist culture in the military, who's standing for traditional, he's afraid that it'll hurt his career. I spoke to him before and after the election. Before the election, he said, well, if we have a change of administration, you know, things can start changing up. And other senior commanders have said, look, this is going to take years for us to get back on track, but we can do it. And he was confident then. I spoke to him after the election and well into sort of the Obama administration, in which he'd seen no action on this front.
So you've been following the influence of fundamentalism on politics and in the military for several years now. Are you going to keep on that story?
No. I think I have done my time with fundamentalism, and that, you know, I got into this because I just love the varieties of religious experience in American life, and there's so much fascinating things, and there's so many, even within fundamentalists, there's so many movements that are beautiful and kind of wonderful. And having spent all these years looking at these sort of some dark places, I'm very interested now in working on a new book that's going to be looking at things that I believe are more hopeful. the way religion intersects with art and music and so on. That's all there, and that's all always been a presence. And I'm in, shaped by my research on fundamentalism in that regard too. And you know, it's almost because the politics drove this. There wasn't time to write about all the creativity that's even within the fundamentalist tradition, maybe especially within the fundamentalist tradition.
Jeff Charlotte, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Jeff Charlotte's new book is called C Street. You can read an excerpt of it, find links to other Fresh Air interviews with Charlotte, and find a profile of Senator Jim DeMint on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Film director Mark Romanek got his start making music videos with such artists as Michael Jackson, Madonna, Jay-Z, Nine Inch Nails, and Johnny Cash. He won 3 Grammys for his videos. Romanek also wrote and directed the feature film One Hour Photo, a psychological drama starring Robin Williams as a lonely photo technician in a large discount store. Romanek's new film, Never Let Me Go, stars Carey Mulligan, Keira Knightley, and Andrew Garfield. It's based on a book by Kazuo Ishiguro, who wrote The Remains of the Day. It tells the story of 3 young people raised at a secluded English boarding school, where we learn their lives are conscribed by a dark secret, one that involves science fiction-like advances in modern medicine. Romanek spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. In this scene from Never Let Me Go, a teacher at the school, played by Sally Hawkins, has decided to tell her students the truth about the school and the lives they can expect to lead.
The problem is, you've been told and not told. That's what I've seen while I've been here. You've been told, but none of you really understand. So I've decided I'll talk to you in a way that you will understand. Do you know what happens to children when they grow up? No, you don't. Because nobody knows. They might grow up to become actors. Move to America. Or they might work in supermarkets. Or teach in schools. They might become sportsmen or bus conductors or racing car drivers. They might do almost anything. But with you, we do know. None of you will go to America. None of you will work in supermarkets. None of you will do anything except live the life that has already been set out for you.
Well, Mark Romanek, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you very much.
That's, of course, from your film Never Let Me Go. Sally Hawkins, one of the teachers at this school, Hailsham, telling the kids the truth about the lives that they will lead. And she's in the film, she goes ahead and reveals their fates. How much do you want to tell audiences about what's actually in store for the for these kids, what they've been prepared for?
Well, the book is a beloved book, and it's been read by millions of people. So, you know, there's going to be a lot of people that come to the movie, and they're going to have all the knowledge, and the secrets and the mysteries will already have been revealed to them. Those people seem to still get emotionally wrapped up in the film, and if anything, having some of that knowledge, you know, renders the some of the early scenes filled with even more pathos for them. You know, it's always nice if people can come in with no preconceptions whatsoever, and then it's sort of like reading the book for the first time, and you're surprised by things, and your, you know, twists are shocking and fun.
Now, the film is set in England in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, but not the 70s, 80s, and 90s that we know. It's a world in which there have been major medical breakthroughs, and it's, in fact, some of those medical breakthroughs which have given these kids and this secluded boarding school its special role in society. But while it's all based upon high-tech medical miracles, the school itself is anything but modern. I mean, it's almost ramshackle. Tell us about the contrast between that sort of modern medicine and the atmosphere that these kids live in and grow up in.
Well, Kazuo's idea was that if there had been breakthroughs in genetic engineering and biotechnology, sometime after the Second World War, in the same way that there were breakthroughs in nuclear science, nuclear energy, nuclear weapons, these genetic breakthroughs would have become part of the fabric of our society, just the way we sort of take nuclear energy and nuclear weapons for granted now that they're part of our society. Because he posited this alternate history, it is a period piece. It's just a period where, in England, where history has taken this tangent that he came up with. And so I thought it was an opportunity to create this sort of retro science fiction futurist thing. There wasn't any real place for the usual tropes that you find in a science fiction film, like gadgets or futuristic buildings. It was sort of beside the point. And if anything, because the film is essentially about the preciousness of time and how little time we all have, making the film actually feel old, and for everything to have the effect of time and the wear and tear of time and the use by humans and all that stuff felt like the right textural kind of context for the story. But I also want to say that it's not at heart a science fiction film. The film is a love story. It's a tragic love story, very, very sad and very beautiful love story. The point is, if people go expecting to see a science fiction film, I think they'll be disappointed.
Right. It's really people acting out very human needs and emotions in a world that is circumscribed by a scientific transformation in a way.
Well, Kazuo was looking for a way to concertina, as he put it, the human lifespan, down to 25 or 30 years, so that all of these pressing questions about our mortality and how little time we have would be kind of heightened and compressed and depicted by these young people. The device that he used to do that, he said, came fairly late or very late in his process. It didn't almost matter to him what he came up with that would allow him to create that scenario of young people whose lives would be compressed by down to 25 or 30 years.
The young people in this film, both as kids and as adolescents, have been sheltered and they lack experience with the outside world. Talk a little bit about how you create these characters or direct these characters so that to convey that ignorance of the outside world, that innocence.
Well, the first thing you do is cast really gifted people and smart people. And we had that with all of the actors, including the young children that play the younger versions of Carrie, Kira, and Andrew Garfield's characters. A lot of it was in the rehearsal. We spent a lot of time just talking around the script and around the characters and the themes and what they meant to everyone. The film is unusual in that the whole first 20 minutes or so, the film is played by these 12-year-olds. And that's unusual in a film. Usually there's a scene or two, and then you kind of hand it off to the older actors. But this was different. So a lot of the concentration in the rehearsal was how to help these young people and have them start to blur a little bit with the behavior of the older actors. I was very rigorous about trying to cast young people that really strongly resembled their older counterparts, because I feel that usually doesn't work very well in films. I had the older actors play the younger actors' scenes so that they would have these sort of sense memories of those moments, and I had the younger actors observe the older actors playing the scene so that it was kind of a sneaky way to get them to see what a more experienced actor would do.
Huh.
We went to the location and I just let them play. I let them play Frisbee and hide and seek, and I wanted them to be familiar with the layout of the school so that it felt familiar to them, and the older actors would have memories of actually having spent time there. Rehearsal is really interesting, fun, a creative part of the process. It's one of the rare times when there isn't some horrendous time pressure and you can just sort of experiment and explore. The actors, who are very professional and very dedicated, they go off and they do their homework. They work on every scene. They learn their lines. And then when they came into film, there was very little that needed to be said. It was my job at that point to try to create an environment where they could relax and stay out of their way and hopefully just sort of film it beautifully and not miss anything.
There are science fiction films where you have characters who are caught in some dilemma where they can't realize their lives because of some strictures that are placed on them. They're cyborgs, or they're in love with a cyborg, and they often run. I mean, they defy the restrictions that science has put upon them and try and go live in the society, or they shoot their way into the real world. these characters have a very special role that's been defined for them. And it seems like if they wanted to flee, they could. And they don't. What holds them to their task?
Well, you know, Kazuo speaks very eloquently about this topic. He said that he never set out to write the story of the brave slaves who rebel against their oppressors. It's not a story that he was interested. He feels there's other good versions of that story. He's more fascinated by the ways in which we tend not to escape our fates. He's written book after book about it. And I think we all feel like this is perhaps a more authentic depiction of the human predicament.
So the lives of people who accept their lots are more interesting in this case than the few who rebel.
Yeah, I think Kazuo feels it's a matter of perspective, that we all have a rather small perspective. We live in a bit of a bubble of our lives. And if we could have a wider perspective, there may be instances where we would fight and rebel and kick against our situation in life, but we tend not to. We stay in the marriage that doesn't work. We stay in the job that doesn't work. I think this is what interests Kazuo about people. It's also it's a sort of an American conception that one has to fight against the oppressor. In Japan, it's considered, I think, heroic to fulfill one's duty to society. In England, there's a class system that's still quite pervasive that sort of frowns upon people attempting to rise above their place in life. It's a very American thing to think that everyone always has to run and escape and fight.
I wanted to talk about One Hour Photo, the feature film you directed in 2002, I think, right? Wrote and directed,
yeah.
Right? And it's the story of this kind of lonely, emotionally starved man who develops film at the one-hour photo desk of a big discount store and kind of develops an obsessive interest in a young family whose picture he has developed for many years. This was an original screenplay. You wrote this. Where did the idea of this character come from, this photo guy?
Well, I've been always fascinated by those giant, overlit, overly stocked American discount department stores. They just always seem like visually really striking places. And I said, there was a guy that worked at the local one-hour photo place where I lived in West Hollywood. And the guy was kind of a strange character. He sort of was always seemed like he was on stage. He was trying too hard. He was always trying to be overly charming and overly familiar with his customers. And it just started to suggest a strange story to me where if he were to be developing the photos of people whose lives are more maybe richer than his or filled with more joy than his, well, families and vacations. And when I thought of that, this kind of three acts of a movie kind of flooded into my mind, and I thought it might make for an interesting story.
Well, the character, Cy Parrish, is played in your film by Robin Williams, and I thought we'd listen to a clip. It's a voiceover where Cy Parrish, the character, is just talking about his work and about pictures.
I'm sure my customers never think about it, but these snapshots are their little stands against the flow of time. The shutter's clicked, the flash goes off, and they've stopped time. Just for the blink of an eye. And if these pictures have anything important to say to future generations, it's this. I was here. I existed. I was young. I was happy, and someone cared enough about me in this world to take my picture.
And that's from the film One Hour Photo, directed by our guest Mark Romanek. You know, I love that clip because it captures what a lot of the film brings, which is this sense of mystery and kind of the quiet desperation of this character, Cy Parrish. As we said, he's played by Robin Williams. And it occurred to me that if I were casting a role and I wanted somebody who would be, as this character is, pretty nondescript, pretty intensely private, Robin Williams would not be my first choice. I mean, he's this, you know, comic with all this energy and this enormously expressive face. How did he get into this role?
Well, you know, it's one of those counterintuitive choices, I guess, where it doesn't make sense on paper, but it makes sense in the more important ways, maybe. You know, I'd heard through the grapevine that he was looking to do some dramatic work and he wanted to maybe do some independent cinema. And I just thought it was an interesting choice, you know, and when I met him, I said, you know, the only thing I will ask of you is if you're willing to kind of physically transform yourself so that we can create a situation where people could perhaps forget that it's the movie star Robin Williams. And of course, as an actor, he was excited by that notion. I think that thing you're talking about, that sort of, we all know that there's this sort of volcano of energy, comic energy, and when it's that suppressed in this film, because we, in the back of our minds, we know that that potential is there, it sort of infused a lot of these very small scenes with a lot of tension. So it ended up working out. I thought he was really, really brilliant in the film.
Right, and you feel badly for him from the beginning. I mean, he's clearly a lonely man, and emotionally starved and desperately wants to connect with this family. And he sort of becomes a stalker in a way. And I suppose it could be seen as sort of creepy, although, you know, I saw it years ago and saw it again as we prepared for this conversation. And it didn't feel that way to me. And I've read that you sort of see this film as a love story of sorts. Explain what you mean.
Well, I guess I like those films where you're not sure how you're supposed to feel about the character. You don't know where they stand morally or ethically, and you're not sure where you stand in relation to them, and your relationship to the characters kind of, you know, flip-flops as the film goes on. I mean, I just find that engaging, and I didn't want you to be sure about how you felt about him. He's clearly doing illegal and inappropriate and super creepy things, and yet you still have a lot of sympathy for him. You're not so sure that he's really doing any great harm, and you're not sure where it's all going to go. And, you know, I hope that that creates a certain kind of engagement with the film that's not passive, where you really have to pay attention and decide how you feel about things. I guess I just like films like that sometimes. You know, sometimes it's great to have, okay, here's the good guy, here's the bad guy. But I also like those kind of gray areas in certain kinds of films, too. So that's what we were exploring. I mean, I think he fell in love with this family. It represented everything that he never had in his life and dreamed of. And then, you know, whether he's going to do them harm or not is what creates the suspense in the film.
You've had quite a career directing music videos. 3 Grammys, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I thought we'd talk about one of them, which got a lot of attention, the video of Johnny Cash singing Hurt. First of all, just tell us a little bit about this song.
Well, it's a song written by Trent Reznor of Nine Inch Nails, who's about as far away from Johnny Cash's world of music as you can imagine. But Johnny worked with a record producer and record company executive, Rick Rubin, over the last decade of his career. And I think Rick expanded the range of what kind of music Johnny could make. He also, you know, kind of stripped a lot away and exposed just the kind of the raw, natural gift of Johnny Cash in his work. And I think it was Rick's idea that Johnny cover this song, and it turned out to be an extremely inspired idea because the song is his version of the song, and it's a cool song to begin with, is unbelievably chilling and moving.
Well, let's listen to some of it. This is Johnny Cash singing Hurt, the song by Trent Reznor.
I hurt myself today to see if I still feel. I focus on the pain, the only thing that's real. The needle tears a hole, the old familiar sting. Try to kill it all away, but I remember everything. What have I become? My sweetest friend, everyone I know goes away in the end.
Now, tell us a little bit about the circumstances of shooting this video. It looks like a lot of it's in an old house with a lot of Johnny Cash memorabilia.
Well, Johnny, you know, was ailing towards the end of his life, and he didn't feel well enough to travel to Los Angeles. Rick Rubin said, just get on a plane, fly to Nashville and shoot something, because if you don't shoot something this week, you'll never have another chance, because he was going to go, Johnny goes off to his ranch in Jamaica every winter for his health. So we just got on a plane with my producer, a cinematographer, and didn't know what we were going to do. And we met Johnny in his house, and we didn't have any budget, so we just shot in his house. That's Johnny's house. And then Rick called me and he said, you should go check out the House of Cash Museum in Hendersonville. And I went there and it was, you know, it had been closed for something like 12 years and it was all covered in dust and the displays were all broken and falling apart and it looked sad.
This was a museum that his mother had put together, right? The House of Cash Museum, right?
I don't actually know the origin of it. It's shocking that it was closed because it was really fascinating. There were all sorts of amazing things in there. But what happened was Johnny was in poor health, and so I said to myself, well, we either try to prettify it and try to hide that, or we just show the way he is. And I was inspired, I guess, by the candor of Johnny Cash's whole career and the way that he handled himself. I just decided, it doesn't feel right to do Johnny Cash and try to fake something or cheat something. So I said, if he's not in good health, then that's what we're going to show. And if the museum is in a state of disrepair, then that's what we're going to show. And that those two ideas started to kind of harmonize with each other, resonate off each other. And then when we were touring around the House of Cash Museum, the woman said, oh, and here's Johnny's archive. And she opened this door, and there was this vault just filled floor to ceiling with tapes and film canisters. And we went, wow, what is this stuff? So we took some of that stuff back to L.A., and without even really knowing a lot of what it was. And then when we cut some of that stuff of Johnny as a young, vibrant man up against Johnny coming towards the, what we didn't know, but was coming towards the end of his life, we really got chills up and down our spine. And that's when we realized that there was a chance to do something much more powerful and emotionally strong than you usually see in your average music video. It became rapidly apparent that we were making a short film about a great, great man and mortality and... It all fell together in this very kind of intuitive way.
The song itself is, I guess it's about a junkie, right? Kind of reflecting on a broken life and harm he's caused and regrets that he has. And Johnny Cash at this point is elderly. His face is wrinkled. His voice is shaky. But as you were with him, did it seem he felt burdened with regrets about his life, or was it simply him at an older stage of his career?
No, we talked about it, and he connected very deeply with the message of the song. I mean, he felt he had caused a lot of wreckage from his own drug and alcohol use, that he had lost a lot of beloved friends because of drugs and alcohol. And, you know, I think that infused his performance with a lot of sadness and regret that was not feigned. There's a scene in the video where it was the last take we were going to do, and he was sitting at this table that was laid out like a feast. And I said, you know, John, this is probably going to be the last take we're going to do. So if you want to do something crazy or bold, go ahead. You know, if you want to sweep everything off the table or if you want to throw something, like, let's do something strong here. And he thought for a second. He said, just roll the cameras. We rolled the cameras, and he picked up this glass of wine, and he just dumped it out on the table. It was his way of expressing his contempt for the thing that had caused so much pain in his life and in other people's lives. And it was an amazing moment that we were lucky enough to capture on camera.
Did he see the final product? Did you talk to him about it?
I didn't talk to him after that. I know that Rick spoke to him and his family. They were very, very moved by the video, and they were very shocked by its candor. And there was some discussion about whether it was a good thing or a bad thing. And I was told that it was John who said, no, it's really good. Let's put this out. It's okay. It's the truth. And, there's Johnny Cash for you.
You've directed a lot of music videos, and it seems so different from a feature film. I mean, so many quick cuts, and it's often more about mood and tone than story. Do you think there are ways that your experience as directing music video made you a better film director?
Well, I became very comfortable with the craft, you know, of the technical side of it, which can be kind of cumbersome. And that's one of the best things about it was it became like this elite film school where I actually got paid to make these kind of short films. And I deliberately tried very many different kinds of aesthetics and different equipment and all sorts of stuff just so I could learn the craft. So then when it came time to making a film, I wasn't worried about that stuff so much. It became almost second nature, and I could focus my attention on the far more important things when you're making a feature film, which is, you know, modulating the telling of the story and helping your actors to do their best work. Those are the things that matter when you're making a film. I would hate to be like a first-time film director where I had to do all that and then, you know, worry about all the technical stuff and that being new to me as well. I mean, you know, you said it yourself, the rhythms of a music video are much more accelerated, and it's all about energy, and it's a different assignment than adapting a Kazuo Ishiguro novel.
Well, Mark Romanek, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Mark Romanek spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies. Romanek directed the new film Never Let Me Go. We have an excerpt of the novel Never Let Me Go, clips from the film, as well as links to music videos directed by Romanek on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our associate producer, John Sheehan, is not here today for a great reason. It's the first day of his honeymoon. He got married last Saturday. Congratulations, John. I'm Terry Gross.